CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Duke-Masaba, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time of the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it is Friday. What is today? March 22nd, 2024. The headlines, the breaking story out of Washington has to do, it's almost such a joke. House sends $1.2 trillion spending bill to Senate hours before deadline. Once again, we're having one of our, what's it like, every 6 months or every 3 months, I've lost track, of threatened shutdown of government. Apparently, they can't do anything. MAGA Speaker Johnson's constantly looking over his shoulder to see what Trump is telling him to do, instructing him to do. Chuck Schumer is always sort of standing in the Senate going, what can we do? How can we deal with these people? It's like the same script every 6 or 3 months, 4 months. I forget how many. The curious thing is that here in Chicago, my beloved town of Chicago, we have a core of citizens dedicated to the notion that is utter chaos in City Hall. That's the constant refrain being put out by, I mean, Cranes, the Tribune, the Sun-Times, the business class, you know, just corporate Chicago. It just so irritates them that Mayor Brandon Johnson was elected, that they're constantly putting out this refrain that it's just utter chaos at City Hall. And just recently, just this last week, Rich Gaites, who's the chief of staff, Mayor Johnson, announced he's retiring. And now suddenly the same chorus. Oh, my God. How will we operate without Rich Gaites? I'm laughing like, guys, no one cares who the chief of staff of the mayor. They go through chiefs of staff like once a year at least. It's a burnout, thankless job. It's a miracle the guy lasted this long. If I did a trivia question to every Chicagoan as to who Lori Lightfoot's chief of staffs were, or who Mayor Rahm's chief of staffs were, or who Mayor Dan's chief, no one would pass the test. So stop trying to make a crisis out of the chief of staff. You guys are so blatant in your attempt to depict chaos and confusion in Chicago. Meanwhile, compared to Washington, oh, my God, it's like a well-organized card game in Vegas. You know, the trains are running. Train just went by. I guess the bar is low. All right, without further ado, I'm going to bring on my distinguished guests. We have a lot to cover. Unique for this guest, we're going to talk a little local politics near the end. So, distinguished guests, introduce yourself.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be here. I am David Ferris, Associate Professor of Political Science, Roosevelt University, here in the great city of Chicago. columnist at Slate, Newsweek, author of It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. And the way that I think about this, like, Washington budget thing is that instead of governing, Congress has essentially set the federal budget to be like a Netflix auto renewal subscription, you know, like, so once a month, you just get a notice that's like, Netflix has renewed your subscription. Like, we've re-upped on the $1.2 trillion budget. You know, like, no need to do anything. It'll happen automatically. Thanks so much. It's really fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of angst compared to Chicago. We're going to get to Chicago in a little bit. David and I don't usually talk local politics because there's so many other people coming to the show that talk local politics. It's not his area of expertise. But before I get into your latest, one of your latest columns, which was like a horror story, like it was basically predicting just a very scary ride, which may not end well for the next few months. Let's start off because it kind of related. So on Tuesday, Illinois had a primary, and in Chicago, the estimate I saw was roughly a turnout of 22%. That's the last estimate I saw. They're still counting mail-in votes, so it'll probably go up, but it's going to be low. And so more gloom and doom about democracy, the state of democracy. Here we are fighting, David, against Trump and the end of democracy. You know, he looks like he could get away with this attempted coup. The Supremes have given him the rubber stamp approval to have another coup if he wants. It does. Here in Chicago, where democracy still exists, 22% turnout. Nobody wants it. Maybe you and I are just like oddballs here. We believe in democracy. Your thoughts on the abysmal turnout?
Yeah, it's very frustrating, Ben. I mean, you know, the referendum, the margin was relatively close on the Bring Chicago Home referendum. I think with a little bit of higher turnout, it could have passed easily. Again, this isn't my area of expertise, right? So I don't know like what the decision process was in terms of putting this referendum on this particular ballot. But what we know about primary turnout in a presidential election year is that if the primary is effectively over, the top of the ticket draw to get people to the polls is gone, you know? And so Joe Biden has this thing wrapped up, for better or for worse. You know how I feel about it. So you don't have that big draw. And that put like the entire onus for turnout on the organizers of this referendum and the folks interested in the Cook County state's attorneys at race and stuff like that. The reality was that just it wasn't enough to break through the noise of everyday life and get people to turn out. I mean, primary turnout's going to be lowish anyway. That's just the nature of the system that we have in place here. It leaves a very small minority of the electorate making really important decisions in low turnout elections. And I don't really understand why the decision was made to put this referendum on the primary ballot. I know they wanted to get something done immediately, right? But like kind of knowing that the turnout was going to be low, I think, you know, it's this hindsight's 2020, right? But I think the turnout was what obviously went wrong here. I think the reason is that Biden has wrapped up the nomination and nobody felt like much was at stake in a presidential preference primary. And so here we are, right? Like everybody's like, do something about the homeless crisis. And we're like, okay, how about this? And they're like, no, not that. Make it go away without raising my taxes at all, you know? You know, it didn't break through for whatever reason. That's very disappointing. I know a lot of people are kind of licking their wounds and trying to figure out how to get something done about the homelessness problem in Chicago. And, you know, all I can say is, you know, my sympathies are with the organizers of that referendum. And I know how disappointing that is. I'm disappointed. I blame Joe Biden. So there it is.
I blame Joe Biden. Why not? Everybody else blames him. So probably just to go back to the point you made, why you need to do it now instead of November when there will be a bigger turnout. If I know the prevailing thoughts of organizers in Chicago, they chose it exactly for that reason. They thought in a lower voter turnout, it would be easier to pass. That's Chicago. It's always looking for the easy way out when it comes to politics. And so my guess is that's the reason. Now, I'm going to remind you of something you said. I've been quoting you like crazy. I think it's about a month ago that you said it. I've lost track of time. I had asked you a question about Michigan and the uncommitted vote in Michigan. And even though many more people voted uncommitted, follow me in this, listeners, I'm going into the land of numbers. Even though many, many more people voted uncommitted in terms of just sheer numbers, the percentage of uncommitted votes was roughly the same as in 2012 with Barack Obama. And so I said, why is that? Why was Joe Biden able to sustain the same percentage as Barack Obama? What prompted the greater turnout? And you said, well, it was a contest. The Biden people took it seriously. They turned people out. And I'm quoting you, like, David Ferris said this. And think about this, ladies and gentlemen. Like, maybe the Biden political campaign apparatus isn't as anemic as the New York Times tells us. Okay. And so I was quoting you again on Tuesday, because clearly Joe Biden didn't take the uncommitted vote in Illinois serious. There was an effort, David, by lefties not to vote in the presidential campaign. But it wasn't nearly as organized or as well covered as the effort in Michigan. And to figure out what the results were, you would have to do, which of course I did, a little bit of calculation. So it wasn't as easy to track as the uncommitted vote, which was literally a vote. You could vote uncommitted. So how do you think about what I call the Ferris theory, whether you want it or not, that Joe Biden's political machinery is not as anemic as being reported?
Well, look, I mean, I think when they think something is at stake, they can successfully mobilize people to get out and turn out and vote. One of the problems with the effort here to do something similar to Michigan is that the election machinery didn't permit it in the same way that it does in Michigan, right? Like, there was no uncommitted option on the ballot. And so the organizers of the campaign, as best as I understand, I wrote in Gaza for the presidency. Okay, that's what I did. But I was getting conflicting signals about whether it would be best to leave it blank or to cast a write-in ballot. I don't think anybody really knew whether the write-ins would be tabulated. I think the Secretary of State said no, because the write-in candidacy had not been filed, right? So that's a little bit of a confusing thing for activists and then for them to navigate. And I think that the Biden team just figured it probably wasn't even really on their radar, right, in the same way. Even though, yeah, I mean, there was an organized effort to do something to send a message to Joe Biden. I think that message reached a lot of committed progressive activists. It seems like something in the neighborhood of 40,000 people left the top of the ticket blank, which is a lot more than in the last contested primary, as I understand. There was a report in These Times, I think, about this. So it had an impact, right? But it didn't break through in the same way that the Michigan effort did. I think that's in part because Michigan is perceived to be like the Arab American capital of the country in a way that Illinois is not, even though we have quite a large Arab American population here, especially in the suburbs. But for whatever reason, it just didn't become a media thing. And because it didn't become a media thing, there was no counter mobilization. And thus, you know, top of the ticket turnout was pretty low.
So, all right, here you go. Here's your trivia question for the day. Which ward, and I am the only nerd who took the time to break this down. So I spent like 15 minutes of my life breaking this down. And I've been throwing these questions at poor unsuspecting guests for the last. No one's gotten it right, by the way, which I kind of take delight in. So here we go. In your humble opinion, which ward in the city of Chicago had the highest number, or the highest percentage, I should say, of no votes in the presidential election? Which ward?
Okay, so I'm just throwing darts at the wall here. Okay, but my guess would be whatever the ward for like Albany Park is, because I think there's a pretty significant Arab American population there. That's where all of my favorite like Lebanese restaurants are. And so that's my assumption.
That is a very good guess. That ward is the 33rd ward. The alderwoman is Rosanna Rodriguez, who is sort of the leader in the city council. In terms of speaking up for Palestinians in Gaza, and as such gets a lot of attention. She was running a campaign encouraging people not to vote in the presidential. And so the 33rd ward, there was roughly 30% no vote, but it was not number one. Number one was your home ward, the 50th ward. And I just, listen, Chicago, this is, you are a very interesting city, to put it mildly. So the 50th ward is the only ward in the city with an alderman who is Jewish, and that'd be Deborah Silverstein, who was leading the charge for Israel in the city council debate. She was sort of a Rosanna Rodriguez, I don't know, chief adversary in this debate that we've had on a couple of resolutions. And she is virtually unbeatable in that ward. She's been elected, I forget how many times. And yet it's also the ward with a large contingent of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans that live in that ward. And there's a cadre of lefties in that ward as well. And so that ward, I just shake my head. Jewish Americans and Arab Americans, you know, they're at odds on the issue of Israel and Palestine, but they live on top of each other. They can't get away. Yeah. Okay. And by the way, you want to bring them together? Propose to put some Venezuelans in that ward. Then you'll see the Jewish Americans and the Arab Americans. We may have our differences in the Holy Land, but no, Venezuelans. Don't act like you're better than that 50th ward. I'm just, anyway, the 50th ward. When I saw that, David, I just shook my head at Chicago. What a weird city we are. You know what I'm saying?
It's really wild. I would not have expected that. But I guess I'm going to just say my vote was really, really important then. Or my lack thereof.
Who knows if it was even recorded? What a democracy. All right. Let's talk your last column, predicting gloom and doom, or a bumpy ride, I should say, not gloom and doom so much as a bumpy ride. And you were concentrating on the impact of third parties. And I thought, let's do a little tutorial on third parties. So I guess the third party candidate with the most attention is the man I happily call Baby Bobby Kennedy, then Robert Kennedy Jr., and he's the son of Robert Kennedy. I can see no similarities whatsoever in their trajectory, David, as public figures. Bobby Kennedy, the old man, started as a very conservative Democrat, an aide, believe it or not, to Joseph McCarthy in the Senate hearings, and then constantly was moving left. He was evolving toward the left when he, leading up to his assassination in California, and a lot of old lefties are very sad and still to this day are sad and upset about the potential that was lost when he was killed. Baby Bobby, on the other hand, started on the left and has been drifting right on pretty much every issue. With every now and then, he has like a spasm of support for something remotely Bernie Sanders-esque, and then it's drowned out. Why don't you talk a little bit more about what forces in American politics the kid, Baby Bobby, Bobby Jr. represents?
Well, I actually think that that's like a huge mystery, right? I mean, so Kennedy announced this run earlier this year and was sort of instantly polling in the double digits. You know, as soon as we had a Kennedy running for president, that Kennedy was hitting, you know, 15, 20, and 25% in some polls. And it's pretty fascinating because I don't actually think most people know who he is. You know what I mean? Like, they know the last name. I'm sure they can figure out Robert Kennedy Jr. is Robert Kennedy's son. But he's definitely not a baby. He's 70. You know, so he's best known for his anti-vaccine stuff, right? That's the thing that he spent the most time going on Fox News and yapping about over the last 3 years, skepticism about vaccines and hostility to, you know, the medical establishment, stuff like that, which is very interestingly a sort of sub-faction of both the far left and the far right in our politics is anti-vax, right? It's not all right-wingers. And that seems to be like what his campaign has been talked about for the most, is like the rightward drift on this particular issue. He also sounds very right-wing about Israel when he talks about it. And for the most part, the rest of his campaign has been like almost completely ignored by the media. You know, so they'll cover him as a spoiler. They'll talk about the anti-vax stuff. But I don't think either of those things really explains his level of support, nor do I think it's necessarily an accurate take on like who he might draw from if anybody starts to pay real attention to him beyond Fox News, and I think that that time is probably now, just given the polling, I think you're going to find his issue positions are really a like hodgepodge of things from the right and the left. But to be honest, on the website, it's a lot more left stuff than right stuff. Like if you go through his economic platform, things he says about racial justice, all these things. Some of his plans look like they're borrowed from the Green Party or borrowed from Bernie Sanders. Other things are kind of weird. And I have yet to encounter a Kennedy voter in the wild. So I don't know who these people are who are telling pollsters they're going to vote for Kennedy. I don't know whether they're committed to him. My guess is the support is pretty soft. And based mostly on a name recognition and a nostalgia for the Kennedys. But I don't know that, right? Like, and in spite of his lack of any real visibility nationwide, he's sticking in the double digits in polling, which is we have not had a third party candidate doing this well in a generation since Ross Perot in 1996. So it's a real wild card. You know, Baby Bobby is himself like completely insane. that's just, I think it's the chief obstacle to his candidacy is that he is a complete crackpot, right? Who seems to have lost his mind. But as we've discovered over the last 10 years of American history, Ben, being a crackpot who's lost his mind is actually no impediment whatsoever to becoming president. So who knows, right? Like, I think that people are just starting to pay attention to this. The pollsters are starting to do more 4- and 5-way polling than head-to-head polling. And I think that's good because it's going to give us a sense of like, well, what are the actual challenges that Biden needs to overcome here? It's not just Trump. It's Kennedy. It's Cornel West. It's Jill Stein. It's whatever huckster the no labels grifters are going to pick to run nationwide. And so it's like we have a much more crowded third party space than we've had in a long time. And a lot of younger voters, like people really any younger than me, aren't going to remember anything other than Nader in 2000. And like this is going to be a new experience for a lot of people. Let me put you that way.
Well, I'm going to throw you my theory and get your thoughts. I have been following Baby Bobby's campaign to a certain degree for many different reasons. And I note that because of his wife, Cheryl Hines, who's an actress, is on the Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David's wife, he has access to podcasts of comedians. And almost every comedian's podcast that he goes on is a comedian who is apolitical. It's the kind of comedian that would fit well with Joe Rogan. In other words, they just make fun. Like their favorite joke is how old Joe Biden is. Okay, that's kind of like where they go, and they ignore. If they talk about Trump, it's oh my god, what a funny guy he is. He's so funny. So they stay out of like the substance of the politics. And if they're going to talk about politics, they just mock the system. They would have two old guys running. And that's where he appears. Okay. And now he said that Joe Rogan was on his short list of candidates to be his vice president. So when I hear that, I'm like, oh, these are Trump votes. I don't care what any poll says. I don't think there's a baby boomer demented enough to think that Baby Bobby is anything like Daddy Bobby, you know? And I can't imagine a baby boomer with nostalgia for what Robert Kennedy Sr. was all about and what ended when he was killed, voting for Bobby Kennedy, no matter what Bobby does to instill that. So my guess is that he's more of a threat to Trump, and you will see Fox drop him like a hot potato, David, if they start getting the word that promoting him will take votes away from Trump. They only promote lefties when they think they could, by doing so, they could cause problems for Biden. That is so clear about the lefty. They will never put you on Fox, okay? You are as lefty as I know, but you will never be on Fox unless you totally are willing to do a Marianne Williamson and badmouth Joe Biden and ignore Trump. Do you follow what I'm saying? So that's my take on it. He's a threat to Trump. Go.
I mean, I think there's a lot to that, right? I think you're absolutely right about the boomers who loved Robert Kennedy. Like when they get wind of what the kid thinks, they're not going to love it, right? But I have a theory about Bobby Kennedy Jr., okay? And it's about, and this isn't even the article, this is just something I've been thinking about. And it's about the ideological space in America that's vacant, like that doesn't have a party behind it. And what it is like the European far right, okay? The European far right is pro-social welfare state, right? Like pro-interventionist government, anti-free trade, anti-immigrant. Right. Many of them are socially liberal in some other ways. Some aren't. It's like there's a bunch of different parties in different countries that are different about these things. But like the core of the European far right is like xenophobia plus support for social welfare policies for white Europeans. OK. And if you run through Bobby Kennedy's webpage, like the Kennedy for President, and you look at through all his issue positions, right, he sounds very lefty about economic policy. And very European far right about foreign policy and about the border. Okay, he does not use, at least on his webpage, he does not use the xenophobic language that European policy politicians use to talk about Islam and stuff like that. But if you look at like what he's actually proposing, it's about like getting the border under control to restore wage growth in the U.S. and to like make it an orderly process. Like he's not against legal immigration ostensibly, right? But like he's sounding a lot of those same notes. Okay. And so somebody who's like socially conservative in some ways and economically interventionist is like the one corner of our four-dimensional political space that has no one representing them in the United States. And I've been saying for years and years and years that if somebody occupied that space, they could make, I don't think they can win, right? But they could make a real splash and maybe even build a movement. It's not a movement that I happen to support, but I've always said, if Republicans could figure out how to stop like attacking Social Security and stop being like just at the complete service of the Chamber of Commerce, that they could actually do a lot better, right? Like they combined their social conservatism, which I find repellent, but certainly obviously has a fair degree of support out there. If they could combine that with like an economic policy that wasn't just like nakedly exploitative, they could do pretty well. And I think that's what Kennedy's trying to do. I think the problem is that he's like too dumb and insane to get it to do it properly, you know. And so that's my take on it, right? Like it's not just that he's crazy. I don't know if you've ever listened to Bobby Kennedy, but he has a disorder. What is it called? It'll come to me. It's a very rare disorder that causes his voice to waver. So he sounds bad kind of all the time, you know. There's a better way to say that. That's not ableist. So I retract that. He sounds not super well to the average person. Like when the average person hears Bobby Kennedy Jr. for the first time, and I've seen this on Twitter like 500 times in the last 10 days, is like a lefty's like, "Yo, what's up with Kennedy's voice, man?" And then somebody's like, "He has this disorder," and they're like, "Delete tweet," you know.
Lefties.
Lefties are like, what does he sell? What's he on? You know, and everybody's like, he actually has an actual disorder. And they're like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I retract that. But it's a thing. It'll become a thing, you know, in the same way that like Biden's lifelong stuttering problem has caused a lot of confusion out there about the difference between like when he's really confused and when he's just like searching for a word as he's been all his life, that kind of thing. Right. Yeah. But the bottom line is that Kennedy is, I think, God, I hesitate to say this word. I think it's a clever strategic move to occupy some ideological space that doesn't have any force behind it right now. And I think that might explain part of his appeal to people, right? He's like, end the forever wars, close, you know, let's get control of the border. But let's, you know, let's do more for the working poor. Like, it's a really interesting combination that I think a lot of Americans are seeing for the first time if they don't pay attention to European politics.
Well, so... the voters I know out there who would be the greatest threat to Biden if they win for Kennedy are lefties, my beloved lefties. And I know so many lefties who they're just not going to vote for Joe Biden. I've mentioned this to you before. And my belief is that if Joe Biden's going to win, he's going to have to win without the lefty vote. And that's just a fact. And what drives them is Gaza. As you pointed out, there was a movement here in Illinois just on Tuesday to write in Gaza instead of Joe Biden. And like I said, it did fairly well in some wards because Biden largely ignored it. None of those lefties are going to vote for Bobby Kennedy once they learn about his attitude toward Palestinians. And so they'll turn elsewhere. There's other options, as you point out, Jill Stein, Cornel West. If you want to literally vote for somebody, there's other options that a diehard leftist can vote for. So he or she does not vote for Joe Biden. But for a diehard leftist to vote, rebel against Joe Biden on the grounds that he is at the very least enabling genocide in Gaza, and then turn around and vote for baby Bobby as a protest vote. I don't even know if nihilism accurately summarizes that ball of confusion and contradictions. Do you follow me, David? You're one of the few journalists I know, and you're not a journalist, you're a political scientist, so maybe this is why you're doing this, who points out what baby Bobby's position on Gaza is. You know what I'm saying? And you're absolutely correct. I remember seeing it on his website or something. Not that literally quote that you used, but his pretty much Trumpian-like support for Netanyahu. I don't know how any leftist could vote for baby Bobby. Your thoughts?
No, I totally agree. Right? I mean, I think his Gaza comments are really pretty outrageous. I mean, there's a laundry list of them. At one point, he called them the world's most pampered people by aid organizations. And, you know, he walked it back a little bit, but like, you know, at heart, he's hostile to the Palestinians, right? And if he gets any kind of sustained press attention to what he actually thinks, rather than just like, wow, there's a Kennedy, look at that. you know, if our media could actually do a little bit of a dive into what he represents and what he believes, I do think it'll pretty much kill any support that he might have from the wing of the left that is disinclined to vote for Biden because of Gaza. Okay. Yeah. Nevertheless, at the moment, when you run a 5-way poll or 4-way poll or a 3-way poll that includes Kennedy, almost every single poll at this point shows him drawing more from Biden. So what we're waiting for is that inflection point, I think, where somebody does a report on it, or it's like somebody gets his issue positions in front of people. And they realize, this is not our guy for Gaza. I think the threat is that he successfully poses as a leftist in enough forums to draw that vote away from Biden. But at a certain point, if you're Bobby Kennedy, if you're baby Bobby, you kind of have to pick a lane here, yeah. Right? Like, do you want to go on Fox News and keep drumming up the anti-vax vote? Because I think that's going to cap you out at like 5% on election day. Do you want to broaden your appeal and try to make a unique case for the ideology that you represent? Like, if that's the case, you need to do more than go on Fox News and get coverage in the right wing press. And you need to not be seen as a stalking horse for the far right, in terms of just like throwing this election to Trump, which is, I think, justifiably what a lot of people think this operation is really about. So, It's a mystery wrapped in a contradiction. This is somebody who used to be like an environmental lawyer, still says and seems to believe a lot of lefty things, but is not being a good member of the left right now, my friend. And so I don't know. I don't know where this is headed. That's why I'm saying, like, the article, I was like, we have a huge wild card in this election.
Yeah.
Right. Like, the secular trend for third party candidates is their polling decreases as you get closer and closer to election day, right? Like, it'll hit a peak like sometime in the late spring, early summer. And then from there, as people start taking a closer look, I think there's a lot of social pressure at work here where somebody that's like, yeah, I'm going to vote for Kennedy, is just going to have like 1,000 uncomfortable conversations with their friends and family as they try to talk him out of it. Like, all these voices in the media, like, you're throwing your vote away. And that tends to dig into their support. And then even further on election day, the gap between a third party candidate's polling, even on election day, and the outcome on election day is usually pretty significant. You know, like people, so there's some certain proportion of people get to their polling place and just like, it just can't do it. You know, they hesitate, they freeze up like a deer in the headlights. If you've ever had the experience of not knowing what you're doing at the voting place, right? It's happened to me a couple times, and it's very, it's like not fun. It's not a fun feeling. So this works on people. You know, people are not blind to the basic strategic logic of American elections, understand that voting for a third party candidate could result in their least favorite candidate or their most feared candidate benefiting from their decision. And so I expect his polling to go down, but he could be the first person since Perot to get into the debates, which would be a game changer in ways that we really can't foresee right now, because we don't know what this guy's going to say, right?
Yeah. No, you have no idea. And by the way, anything's possible in politics. I could easily see Baby Bobby just throwing away all his rhetoric about current positions on Gaza, Palestine, Palestinians, Israel, and become the biggest supporter of Palestine. I could see something so bizarre as that, and in an attempt to take votes away from Biden. That leads me to this question, which we've talked about it briefly on the show. Donald Trump's what I thought was completely outrageous comment, and I'm paraphrasing, that any Jewish voter who votes Democrat hates his religion. I'm astounded by that comment on so many levels. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, he did this in 2020 too, Ben. You know what I mean? Like, he's just incapable of learning. You know, he's incapable of like sitting down with an advisor and that advisor being like, don't tell Jewish Americans that they're like traitors to their people, man. Like that's not a good message. That's not a winning message for you. And the reality is that like for election after election after election for decades and decades and decades, Jewish American voters have been stalwart Democrats by like a supermajority, you know? And I don't see that changing this election. And Trump going out there and being like, voting for Biden makes you a traitor to Israel or a traitor to the Jewish people, or whatever he said. It's not just that it's outrageous. It's that it is like political malpractice of the highest order, you know, because you just can't say that to people. You know, you especially can't say that to people who have been voting for Democrats their entire lives and who are committed to some vision of peace between Israelis and Palestinians, who largely do not approve of the way that the Israeli government is conducting the war. And that means that Trump is really caught out with a pretty unpopular position that he's staked out, right? And that position is like, let Netanyahu do whatever he wants to the Palestinians. I don't care. Kill as many as you want. And that's not a position that speaks to Jewish Americans. You know, it's just not. So, you know, as always, Trump is like his own worst enemy, like at every given moment. It's like, honestly, at this point, you just run a generic Republican out there, like Nikki Haley would win by like 8 points. And Trump really might blow this thing. He might blow a situation where he and his party are very well positioned to beat an incumbent president. And he is doing everything he can to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, you know, as always.
Yeah, the counterpoint was Senator Schumer, the speech he gave where he called. This one blew my mind. I mean, just I would never have imagined this in my lifetime. He called for Israelis to oust Netanyahu. And just, you know, an American politician, a Jewish American politician from New York, where the Jewish vote is so important, calling for regime change in Israel. You know, usually it's like, well, whatever the Israelis do is fine with us. We support it's a democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East. We support the elect. That's generally been the time. David, I'm like, wow, the world is changing in front of me. I'm not quite sure where it's going next. What was your thoughts when you saw or read about Schumer's speech?
I mean, look, this is a dynamic, evolving situation in which I think a lot of like normie Democrats are slowly awakening to the electoral threat that is posed to them by Biden's uncritical support of the Israelis. So that support has gone from uncritical to critical. The thing that hasn't changed is the support, right? So in my mind, instead of being like, let's have Israelis overthrow their government, why not just cut off the aid, right? Like, the aid is really the only leverage that Biden really has here, you know? And instead of talking or floating the idea of cutting it, which is itself a kind of a leverage, even to have the discussion or to leak a discussion, like secret discussions inside the Biden White House about cutting off aid to Israel, that would like set the world on fire for like an entire news cycle, right? They won't even do that. They're like, what if we build a floating pier to deliver aid to the Palestinians? Or like, what if we had Chuck Schumer muse about like Israelis snapping their fingers and calling an election, which they don't have the power to do? It's like every time you get to the point where it's like Democrats realize the problem here and they're going to do something about it, they choose to not really do something about it, you know? And so being like, oh, we're so mad at Netanyahu, here's the check, you know, like, as you're signing the check, you're like, this is outrageous, and you hand it over. You know, it's like, you got to not give the check. You know, like, we don't have anything left to do here other than, like, use the leverage that we have to affect the policy change that you want to see. And instead, we're in the position of, like, you know, we have the presidency, and we just get all these stories about how Biden is unhappy behind the scenes. He's just not friends with him anymore. You know, like, what a betrayal. But he won't do the one thing that could move the Israeli government to stop slaughtering Palestinians, right? And so it's so frustrating to me, not only to see this like terrible injustice unfolding against the helpless people who are themselves being held hostage by Hamas. You see that unfolding, and then you see just like this like unforced political error that no one in the Biden administration can see fit to correct. And my fear is that like, we're all going to pay this terrible price for it. Which is like, Americans are going to let like an authoritarian take over the country to get revenge on Joe Biden and his Gaza policy, which is not going to help anyone in Gaza. So it's just, it's like one of those things where you see the train coming down the tracks and you're just frozen there, like in a nightmare, you know? Yeah. So I don't know. It's not a good situation.
Well, I don't, what, we actually discussed this months ago. The backlash to Biden, if he were to pull aid, you actually, we, I don't know if you remember this, but we talked about this months ago. Just think about that, and you know, what if Joe Biden were to say, "That's it, no more aid, or we're cutting aid, or we're suspending aid." Until you pull out of Gaza, or at least allow, you know, food and medical supplies to enter Gaza, what would the political fallout in this country be?
We don't know, because no one has tried it in so long. I mean, I think the last president to actually suspend aid was Gerald Ford in the 70s, right? So we're all in the realm of speculation here, and like sort of speculative hypothetical polls about what could happen if you do this or that. I want to go back to something I talked about a long time ago in the context of court packing, which was like, I don't actually want to pack the court, right? I want to issue the threat and then change the court's behavior and change Republicans' behavior. And so I talked about the concept of a credible threat and the effect that a credible threat can have on your adversaries in terms of like focusing the mind and getting them to change their behavior, knowing that if they don't, something that they really don't like is coming down the pike. And the fact that no one in the Biden administration has to this day been willing to seriously entertain the cutting off of aid means we simply don't really have a very good idea of what the political impact of it would be. Right? You have a lot of lefties calling for it. You have almost no one in the Democratic Party taking that threat particularly seriously. And I think you could affect real change just by like, again, just like leaking a story to Politico about how serious discussions are taking place inside the White House. about halting the aid or like revisiting the aid or whatever language they want to use. I don't think that Netanyahu is going to do anything differently if he fundamentally believes that Biden is not willing to do this. Right? And so you don't even really have to do it. You have to start talking about doing it. You have to start putting the policy machinery into motion that could execute that change if he wanted to. So, of course, look, if they even talked about it, there'd be like a 5-alarm fire on Fox News, right? Like every day for a month. Biden's an anti-Semite. Biden loves Hamas. Biden is a terrorist sympathizer. But look, they're doing that anyway.
Yeah, they are.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what he could possibly do to stick to Netanyahu like thicker than he has since October. And they're still out there calling him like a terrorist enabler and saying he loves Hamas and Hamas lovers in the Biden administration. Like, this is the thing. I feel like Pete Buttigieg was right about this in the 2020 primary debates, right? He was like, just do the right thing. They're gonna say the same thing about you either way. Like, it doesn't matter what they do, right? They're gonna call you a radical Marxist leftist because you have a D next to your name, right? And that's their game, right? Like, Biden could fly to Israel and like join the front lines, you know, and like personally kill like 15 members of Hamas and like drag their bodies home onto a podium at the White House, and Fox News would be like, boy, I tell you, that Biden's really an anti-Semite, isn't he? You know, it's like he didn't kill him fast enough, you know? Or whatever, right? Like, they'd find some way to paint Biden in the light that they're trying to paint him in, because this is part of their mission. Fundamentally, the facts have absolutely no relationship to what happens on Fox News every night. So keeping that in mind, just do the right thing. Yeah. And the right thing here is to start issuing some threats to try to stop the killing, right? That's fundamentally what needs to happen here. You got to stop the killing. You got to stop the siege. People are starting to starve. You know, there's a massive humanitarian crisis, and you got people in the White House who just still won't pull the trigger on it. And I don't know what to tell you at that point. It's like, I don't know what could change here. Like, what could happen to the Palestinians? Like, what could Netanyahu do that would finally get the Biden administration to use the policy tools at its disposal, take the political risk, right, and do the right thing? I think if you do the right thing and you are actually able to stop the conflict, you will find that whatever Fox News says, that would pay political dividends, and that political dividends would be paid immediately.
I'm with you 100%. And by the way, what Netanyahu could do to ultimately push Biden to act in this crisis is to sort of where he's going right now, and to be overtly political in the U.S. election. So he had Schumer calling for regime change in Israel, and Netanyahu was all but calling for regime change in the United States. And Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, is inviting, planning to invite him to address Congress. He already spoke to the Republicans in the Senate. It's pretty overt. I've long believed that Trump and Netanyahu are one and the same in many ways, and will be working for each other's election. I put Modi in that list as well from India. That's a whole other conversation. It's so clear with me with Netanyahu, and as I've said to you many times, David, Republicans, they have a history on this front of using foreign policy to undermine the Democrats in political in presidential years, 68 with Nixon and the peace talks, 80 with Reagan and Iran and the hostages. So I feel ultimately, and it's, you know, we were talking about this on the show with a lefty this week. The taking a stand to end the slaughter in Gaza will be done for all the wrong reasons. And it doesn't matter what reasons ultimately motivate Biden to do, or the U.S. to do what it can to get food and aid into Gaza, at the very least. You follow me, David? All that matters is that he do it. But it'll be all the wrong reasons. It'll be a total political calculation based on how many no votes there were in the 50th ward or the 33rd ward or the 35th ward or all the lefty wards in Chicago. You know what I'm saying? Someone will go, do you remember Nader vote in 2020? Which never would have gone for Al Gore in a million years, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just saying. It was more the Patrick Buchanan vote in Miami. Go look it up. You know what I'm talking about once you look it up.
The butterfly ballot.
The butterfly. This gets to your point that we were making earlier. When an election is this close and there's so many variables, it's something like the butterfly ballot can put one person over. And in 2020, it put Bush over. And it's so bizarre. Every now and then, David, I think about that, you know. Centrists to this day are blaming Ralph Nader. I'm like, what about the butterfly ballot in Miami?
I said we were talking about, I'm teaching a class on the primaries right now, and we talked about the 2000 election yesterday, and I actually showed my students the actual ballot, and they just looked like, they're like, who designed this ballot? It's the stupidest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And I was like, you can see why people who wanted to vote for Al Gore would have voted for Pat Buchanan, right? You can see it. You can see how this happened. Yeah. And that far exceeded the actual margin in Florida.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm hoping I've been watching Joe Biden inch toward the right thing here. I've been watching it. It's inching is the key word. I have no doubt that the hardcore lefties are not going to vote for him no matter what he does. He personally drop in food to Gaza and they're still not going to vote for him. But it is sort of encouraging, I suppose, among all the bleakness, that this political pressure is forcing him to do the right thing. That's the kind of the take I have when I want to be mildly optimistic.
Yeah, and the stupidest thing that Netanyahu could do is to reinforce the sense that like Israel is part of America's like polarization politics, you know, and that like being pro-Israel is Republican, right? Like that is, I think, the worst strategic mistake that he has made over his career, is like getting involved in U.S. politics and getting into all these like fights with Barack Obama. And that's part of what's been turning the Democratic base against Israel slowly, you know, a couple percentage points a year, to the point where I think the Democratic Party is, you know, closer to being pro-Palestinian than not, right? And that's part of the disjuncture between the Biden administration's policies and the way that they're being received by the party's activist base, is that the party itself, like the people who do the work for the party and who support the party, are no longer like blindly pro-Israel, you know? And that's a new reality that I'm not sure that Biden is really capable of processing or acting on in the way that a younger, more capable, more adept politician could.
Yeah, and just think of it. AIPAC's support of insurrectionist Republicans is so reviled by the Democratic base. You know, I don't know what you could do more to solidify Israel as a Republican issue than have AIPAC support insurrectionists.
And it's crazy because, like, you know, at the Conservative Political Action Conference, they have like Nazis there, like actual Nazis, you know, and Trump has dinner with like Nick Fuentes, who's like one of the worst neo-Nazis in the country. It's all just a game. You know what I mean? Like, these people don't care about Israel at all. They're just using it as a partisan cudgel to beat Biden with. They're going to call us anti-Semites no matter what we do. There has been some progress, right? But like, and you could hear it in the State of the Union, right? Like, Biden seemed to speak a little bit from the heart about Palestinians, like talking about them as human beings,
yeah,
like worthy of the same rights and safety as anybody else. Is progress, right? But we have to, like, that's not going to do it. Like, we have to get some of those lefties back. And I do think some of them are gettable, not all of them, but some of them are gettable. To get some of them back, you really have to effectuate a significant policy change. And maybe we'll see it. Maybe we won't. I don't know. I can't predict it.
By the way, I want to point something out. David Ferris said something today. I wrote it down that I never thought I would hear him say, and it is, and this is a direct quote, Pete Buttigieg was right about this.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I wrote that down. Pete Buttigieg, we should just get that clip, Nate. Just play it over. Now, Pete Buttigieg was right about this. Pete Buttigieg will be sending us flowers. Here's my prediction. We'll close with this. I believe about half of the lefties that, and I'm just throwing that number out, who either wrote in Gaza or just left it blank, will come back, will vote Biden in November against Trump. The other half, you're not getting them. And I know them. Okay. I've been living among them for my whole life. Joe Biden, you're going to win this election. You can't do it with the left, the far, far left. They didn't vote for Biden in 08. I mean, they didn't vote for Obama in 08 or 12. They didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. They didn't vote for Biden. They're not going to vote for the Democratic candidate. I think they hate liberals more than they hate MAGA. So that's my prediction on that one. All right, David. It was an entertaining sort of conversation at times, and gloomy and doomy, and conversation as well. It's kind of where we are politically right now. You know what I'm saying? There's just
that's my brand, Ben. You know, gloomily entertaining. Yeah.
By the way, I'm going to give you a recommendation. I'm giving everybody their recommendation. So there's a novelist named Percival Everett, who's one of my favorite novelists, and he's getting a lot of attention these days because it was his novel from 2002, Erasure, that was used to as the story in American Fiction, which was a very popular movie. He just came out with a new novel called James, and I was telling Nate before the show, I was up until 4:30 reading it. It is a brilliant novel, but this man's a genius. Percival Everett is his name. There's so many writers he's like, but James tells the story, David, of Huckleberry Finn from the point of view of Jim. And so it turns everything upside down, and it is like causing me to completely rethink everything I thought about Huckleberry Finn and Mark Twain, and absolutely brilliant.
I will definitely check it out.
Percival Everett, James. All right. Very good, David. Thank you so much. And I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. All right.
All right. Thanks for having me as always, Ben. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. That's David Ferris. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.